It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
From the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., backed by the trusted voices of Team Fox. Team Fox. A clear, fresh voice cutting through the noise to tell the truth. It's the Guy Benson Show with Guy Benson.
It is Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. I'm Guy Benson. Welcome into the Guy Benson Show, one and all. We're glad you're here. Between 3 and 6 p.m. Eastern every weekday. And if you can't listen during our time slot, that's okay. We prefer it, but we also have a podcast for that. It is free. It is on demand after the show is over. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcasts.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm the political editor at townhall.com. You can read my work there. Also a Fox News contributor over on the TV end of the world. I'll be on Special Report tonight on set here in Washington, D.C. with Brett Baier and the rest of the panel. I think Josh Holmes is with us. Maybe Leslie Marshall. It's going to be a good panel. Look forward to that. Right around 6:45 Eastern time, FNC. Tune in live or set your DVR. Here on the radio show, the lineup starts with Congressman Chip Roy, Republican of Texas, later on this hour. He has been very critical of leadership on, especially over the weekend, these votes involving foreign aid to some of our allies. He's upset that the border was not resolved, our border. I get the point he's making. I don't fully agree, but we'll have a good conversation with him about that and the potential future of Speaker Mike Johnson. In the next hour, Clay Travis, founder of Outkick.com. He will be our guest. Andy McCarthy rounding things out just after 5 p.m. Eastern here. He's been following every twist and turn. Really not that much drama, but the events thus far in this Trump New York City trial in Manhattan. Andy was a federal prosecutor in Manhattan for years, and he is our trusted source on all things legal. He'll be here to break down what he has seen over these last 2 days. With the opening arguments yesterday and some testimony today. That is all ahead on the Guy Benson Show. I want to begin with something that happened yesterday. In fact, we read you the quote from President Biden, and I then watched the video of it last night, and it made me angrier. So the Biden administration finally put out a pretty good statement, relatively strong. Not a lot of equivocation or piling ancillary, unrelated topics into it. They unequivocally, at least in a statement attributed to a spokesman for Biden, someone else wrote it, someone else published it. Maybe they showed it to him, maybe they didn't. But the White House statement about the anti-Semitic campus mob pro-Hamas protests was certainly by their standards good. I think it was belated. I think we should have heard a lot more of this kind of thing from the president himself and others forcefully. This was belated, but still better than nothing. In some ways, refreshing. And then a lot of that brief interlude of quasi-goodwill was eliminated, in my mind, by the president himself, because this was not a written statement authored by someone else in his name or on behalf of his administration. This was actually him. And a question was asked, I believe it was Jackie Heinrich, our colleague. He was at an Earth Day celebration yesterday in Virginia, and there was a question posed to him about these anti-Semitic protests and whether he would condemn them. And he gave an answer that for the first 3 seconds was good, and then things got worse from there. And then there was a follow-up, and notice how someone else swoops in, a different journalist, to kind of rescue Biden. Just listen to cut one.
Condemn the anti-Semitic protests on college campuses.
I condemn the anti-Semitic protests. That's why I've set up a program to deal with that. I also condemn those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians and how they're being...
Should the Columbia University president resign?
Right this way.
I didn't know that. I'll have to find out more about it.
Do you need the
the abortion issue to win the election?
No, I need the abortion issue to follow what's right.
What will your legacy be on abortion?
What will your legacy be as a news person?
All right, so that's a weird final response. What will your legacy be on abortion? I would say his legacy will be someone who pretended to be at least moderate on the issue for most of his career and then threw that all into the garbage can when he felt like his pursuit of power and his political agenda required it. So his legacy on abortion, I think, is a shameful one. But he just laughed at that question and said, what will your legacy be as a news person? Well, at least in that exchange, the legacy will be he was the one who rescued Biden. Like, he was kind of a jerk to this guy. I don't think it was a good question, but he was a jerk to the guy who actually threw him a life preserver, ironically, sickly on the issue of abortion, to save him from what was kind of a morass, some quicksand that he was in. On the Israel question, the anti-Semitic mob. Do you condemn, this is the initial question, do you condemn anti-Semitic protests on college campuses? And he says, I condemn anti-Semitic protests. That's why I set up a program to deal with it. By the way, I'll just remind you, the Biden administration at first on their anti-Semitism task force included CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations. They were actually part of the White House's cultivated group on combating anti-Semitism. CARE, of course, run by a man, the executive director, who publicly gave a speech celebrating the October 7th massacre of Jews after Hamas perpetrated it. And then the White House severed ties. We'll see if that lasts, by the way. But that was a bridge too far, at least for the time being, with CARE. But just to give you a sense of how intersectionality and identity politics works on the left, it's like, oh, well, we have a problem in this country with anti-Semitism. Let's bring in CARE to be a part of the solution. CARE being an unindicted co-conspirator in a terrorism funding federal case, and then the executive director just, you know, blew any pretenses out of the water with the speech that he gave, the remarks that he gave, cheering on the terrorist attack of October 7th. But Biden's bragging about the group that he brought together, the program to deal with anti-Semitism. But then, almost the same breath, I condemn the protests. I also condemn those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians. And he kind of starts to mutter something. He's trailing off. This is what he does, where his train of thought stalls and he trails off. And then he'll typically kind of just like look down and say, well, anyway, kind of where was I? That's a standard feature in this president's cadence when it comes back and forth. Reporter questions. He doesn't do it very often, but we see this quite a bit when he does. And then the follow up. Should the Columbia president resign? He seems to mishear that, saying, oh, I didn't know that. I'll have to find out more. He thought she was informing him that she had resigned. No, the question was, should she resign? And rather than allowing him to finish the thought or maybe expand upon what on earth he meant by saying he's also condemning those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians, this guy, this other journalist, swoops in with a question about Joe Biden's favorite topic, abortion. Of course, he's a radical on abortion. His actual position, if he knows what his actual position is, his administration's actual position, way out of the mainstream with the American people, but they feel like it's a useful cudgel against Republicans. Biden is in Florida today to talk about abortion. He should have sent a bouquet of flowers to this reporter, but instead he kind of ends up sneering and chuckling at him because that's what Biden often does. And maybe he just feels entitled to being saved from precarious situations from journalists because they're on the team. And he's the leader of the team, whether they like it or not. So, hey, it's your job to protect me. You're journalists, after all. So any sense of, ooh, thanks, bro, for bringing it in another direction where I can go back to my rote, I think, really awful talking points on an issue that we're going to make central to the campaign. I can see the thanks that that guy got. But the abortion stuff aside, I just want to reiterate a point that I made as soon as I saw this clip yesterday, or I saw the soundbite transcribed. For Biden to go from I condemn anti-Semitic protests to I also condemn, what, a group of people who don't agree with the screaming pro-Hamas mob, don't understand what the Palestinians, what's going on with the Palestinians. This is why I would love for this president to just occasionally sit down with an actual real journalist where probing follow-up questions are allowed. Because I would very much like to hear the question asked and answered. Well, what do you mean? What is going on with the Palestinians? And who are you condemning as equal to vile, anti-Semitic mob members? You just condemn them. Then you condemn this other group of people who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians. Why are they equivalent? Why are you condemning both? And what is going on with the Palestinians? So who exactly are you condemning here? We didn't get any of that. And other follow-ups were interrupted, as I mentioned, with this diversion over into the abortion issue. But this is Joe Biden's version of the Charlottesville narrative about Donald Trump. Right? The very fine people on both sides remark. And I know a lot of Trump supporters say, actually, that was taken out of context. And what he meant was this, that, and the other. And they turned it into something else. Whatever you think Trump's intent was there, it became a huge media storyline and a massive attack line against him, that Trump was willing to at least make it seem like he was involving in some moral, engaged rather, in some moral equivalency when it came to the people who were at that virulent, racist, anti-Semitic rally in Charlottesville. In fact, Joe Biden himself, his presidential campaign origin story this time around, his third campaign, the previous two, having failed miserably, this time around, what he claimed was he was finally inspired. He felt compelled. He had to run against Donald Trump because of Charlottesville, because of his version and sort of in the popular imagination, certainly in the media bloodstream, the Trump fine people on both sides. He said that is so disqualifying, that's so morally repulsive and wrong. I had to run against this man for president in 2020. And now here we have, and we've been witnessing it, we've been talking about it, documenting it on this show all the time, for months, Charlottesville after Charlottesville after Charlottesville. And rather than angry white men in khakis and tiki torches from Walmart, it's raving left-wingers and Islamists in headscarves and often COVID masks as well, railing against Israel and Zionists and Jews and getting violent, menacing. I mean, there are Charlottesvilles constantly across the country. Trump was harangued and badgered by the press to condemn and to clarify the condemnation. And why did you say fine people on both sides? I mean, it was a five-alarm fire in our politics after that happened. And there's been almost none of that pressure on Joe Biden amid this conflagration of Charlottesville's, where the anti-Semites and the haters and the bigots are of a different strain. The knock on Trump, the claim about Trump, was he didn't want to alienate very ugly elements of his base because he wanted to keep their support. So he did some of this mealy-mouthed, well, what about these people, and there's fine people on both sides and all that. That was, whether you agree with it or not, that was the critique, the indictment morally and politically against Trump about Charlottesville. And here's Joe Biden facing, I would say, not just similar, but a worse crisis, mostly on his side of the overall spectrum, within his tribe, and these horrible people and bigots are people that he wants to placate, whose votes that he wants. And that's why you get so much of this both sides-ism in a conflict where there really aren't two legitimate arguments. The pro-Hamas argument relies on so much misinformation and lies and immoral propaganda that I don't think, certainly at its extremes, which has been embraced by an awful lot of people, it's a legitimate position. I think it's an illegitimate, awful, odious position. But Biden is spending a lot of capital and time and sort of optics and all of that, trying to keep those people within his tribe somewhat on side, somewhat in the tent, and at least less angry so they don't completely ruin his convention in Chicago. That's part of what's going on here. So when the rubber met the road and the moral test that he said Trump failed in Charlottesville, when that mirror image of that test was presented to Joe Biden as president of the United States, he did a people on both sides equivocal answer, an absolute abdication again and failure of leadership, an awful, awful answer. Oh, and by the way, he was down at that event in Virginia for Earth Day with AOC, and he was just pouring on the compliments to her. Again, same deal, same pandering to the same type of people. At that event, AOC said this in cut four.
Today also serves as a reminder of the power of organizing, of what we can accomplish when young people, climate advocates, labor organizers, and working people of all backgrounds come together to demand the future we all deserve. It is especially important that we remember the power of young people shaping this country today, of all days, as we once again witness the leadership of those peaceful student-led protests on campuses like Columbia, Yale, Berkeley, and many others.
Peaceful, she emphasizes, which is wrong. She said that yesterday after a weekend filled with bullying, menacing, intimidation, slurs, and in fact, physical confrontations and violence as well on at least two of the campuses that she mentioned, Columbia and Yale. That was one of her applause lines, with Grandpa Joe nodding along with the whole both sides answer he gave to the question about these mobs. It's just disgraceful. It's hypocritical, yes, that's bad, but at its core, it is disgraceful. That's the president of the United States. More to come on the Guy Benson Show. We are just getting started. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Always fresh, always fair. The Guy Benson Show.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
I'm Guy Benson. We're back. I mentioned Yale, some of the turmoil there yesterday. Got a name check in the previous segment as well. This is where they were ripping down, we played the audio, ripping down an American flag from a war memorial over the weekend and cheering, where a Jewish student was injured in some of the chaos, where there were horrible chants being yelled, where Jewish students were being harassed and chased around. That was Yale. Eventually, the police intervened. New Haven and Yale police came in and cleared that encampment, and one of the sniveling anti-Semitic activist students at Yale, I saw he published a list of the names of the police officers. And a lot of people said this is doxing. This is meant to intimidate these working class cops doing their jobs. He's like, here are the names of these officers who arrested peaceful protesters. They weren't peaceful. They were doing their job. The cops were. But he was listing these people's names publicly. I think we know why. I say use that list to give promotions and raises to all of them, and I buy each of them a beer myself.
America is listening to The Guy Benson Show.
It's The Guy Benson Show. Thank you for listening. GuyBensonShow.com. Our podcast is always free. And with us now is Chip Roy, congressman from the great state of Texas, the 21st Congressional District. And it's good to have you back here.
Guy, great to be on. I hope you are doing well.
Likewise. All right, so let's talk a bit about what happened over the weekend. I know that you ended up voting a way that I would not have voted. I would have voted the other way. But I also understand a number of the points that you have made and your frustrations around the foreign aid dollars going out with the border remaining unresolved. We'll get to the border. It's getting worse again. Just sort of lay out what your argument was as you explained your opposition to what Republican and Democratic leadership, frankly, came together to pass.
Yeah, Guy, well, first of all, thank you, and I appreciate being on your show because you do exactly this. Like, even when we disagree, which actually you and I rarely do, but you know, on a couple occasion we do. And on this one, we disagree, and I appreciate you having me on to explain it. And, look, the short version is this. At the end of the day, the short version, nothing else, for me as a Texan, and you said we'll get to it in a minute on the border, the speaker over the last 5 months has been very clear that we should not advance funding for Ukraine or advance foreign aid generally without securing the border of the United States. He very much tied it to Ukraine. Whether you agree with that or not, he said it for about five straight months. And the American people are frustrated that we never do what we say we will do. But if you back up a step further, I'm 51 years old. I came of age during Reagan. I am predisposed to want to have a strong military and peace through strength. I am predisposed as an American, as a Christian, as somebody who believes in Israel's right to exist, to want to stand shoulder to shoulder with Israel. We spend $3.8 billion every year in our defense budget to support Israel. I'm predisposed to want to do that. But the bill that we had on the floor this weekend was pre-designed as a package to be attached to a Senate bill to achieve the desired outcome that Chuck Schumer, Joe Biden, and Mike Johnson, they agreed in that sort of way they agree in a four corners fashion to pass legislation that would be not really amended or debated on the floor. And the result would be $95 billion unpaid for, which would include funding, for example, in Israel, $9 billion to humanitarian aid, some X number of billion of which will end up in the hands of Hamas through NGOs and other paths. I couldn't support that. I couldn't support moving down the road for additional money unpaid for Ukraine while our borders are wide open. And we don't have a clear mission. And frankly, we've been sending now, we're now at up to $175 billion that I've either already sent or will send to Ukraine without a clear mission or without Zelensky being clear about what he's willing to sit at the table and do. And we're funding endless wars. And one final point, sorry for the filibuster. We are now 25 years in to what I will call the ghost budget of wars. We have been funding wars in the Middle East, now funding war here in Ukraine and everything else, and we never pay for it. We've spent about now $8.5 trillion, give or take, not even counting all of the money we've now spent on burn pits, because we continue to fund wars without then having a debate here at home about what to do about it. I want one Republican to have the nerve to stand up and say, you know what, I believe in war so much, I'm going to vote for a 50% marginal tax rate on people who make over $1 million to pay for it. Then I want to see how many of the donor class and how much the Wall Street Journal editorializes in favor of war.
Okay. And I think a lot of your colleagues, and I assume you like and respect quite a few of your Republican colleagues specifically who voted in favor of these packages, and we have those folks on the show as well, and they gave their explanations for why, and I'm generally persuaded by that side of it, which is why I would have voted with them. But I understand all the points that you're making. I don't think that they're illegitimate concerns to raise. I think it's perfectly within the America First patriotic paradigm to say, hey, if we've got a country fighting the Russians with their own boots on the ground, I want to help them. If we've got the Israelis fighting terrorists on multiple fronts, I want to help them. It's not involving American boots on the ground. I want to help deter China in Taiwan, et cetera. I'm on board for all of that. I do get the point about funding and pay-fors. It's fair. I also get the point about the border and linking it to the Ukraine aid until all of a sudden that linkage just disappeared. One of the counterpoints, and I just want to ask you about this, one of the counterpoints that you'll hear, and this is more from Democrats, like, oh, well, they're demanding action on the border, but on the Senate side, they came up with a compromise, a bipartisan compromise, and all these guys yelled and screamed and said, there's no way that's acceptable. We're not going to even bring it up for a vote in the House. Now, I was against the Senate bill for various reasons. I think we probably agree on that. But they would say, you want the border linked to Ukraine, but when there was a chance to do bipartisan border action, it was rejected by the House. So won't they basically never take yes for an answer, or they only want a partisan Republican bill, which is a poison pill in divided government? So let's at least do the thing that most of us can agree on when it comes to helping some of these allies abroad. That's the counterpoint that some people make. How do you respond to that?
point one is that you're never going to win the argument if you're not serious about it, right? So when the speaker was linking the two, you can't go forward and basically tell the entire world, look, guys, yeah, I want border security and I want to cut spending, but don't worry, I will never shut the government down. Hey, I want reforms to FISA, but you know what? I will absolutely reauthorize FISA no matter what. Hey, you know what? I really want border security, but you know what? I'm going to fund Ukraine no matter what. You lose all your leverage. Now, to the point that you're bringing up with respect to the border policies generally, Democrats did that on purpose. They designed that bill to not achieve the result, knowing it would most likely get turned down, so they could blame Republicans while we're getting absolutely hosed with open borders. You had, I think, me on during that debate. You've opined, and I agree, that bill was flawed. It was designed to fail. It was going to codify mass releases of people into the United States. It was going to codify, quote, alternatives to detention. It was going to spend a whole lot of money to continue to process more people, which means you continue to fund the abuse of asylum and abuse of parole to dump people into the United States. When you have Lake and Riley murdered, when you have hundreds of Americans getting harmed, you got thousands dying from fentanyl, 24,000 Chinese nationals that have come across the border since October 1, an unconscionable number. All of that is happening. That bill was designed very specifically to perpetuate it, to codify it. It would have bound the hands of Trump. It wasn't a serious reform proposal. So my problem with the speaker, respectfully, is if you're going to say it, you got to mean it. You got to look him in the eye and say, I like Mike Johnson believed in the Ukraine funding, like you, right? And if the speaker believes in that, you still have got to be able to look him in the eye and say, you know, Chuck, Mr. President, I'm with you. I want some money for Ukraine to stand up against Putin. But I've got to secure the border of the United States. And I'm telling you, as God is my witness, you're not getting a dollar from Republicans until you secure the border. We'll sit down. We'll figure it out. Otherwise, I'll see you in November. He said he was doing that, and then he didn't do it. And I'm telling you, all the people I represent are calling my office saying thank you. I promise you, it's overwhelming support for my district in a position, despite overwhelming support in my district for Israel, an overwhelming military population in my district.
So another question I have here, just in terms of how this could have gone differently in sort of a counterfactual, let's say Speaker Johnson had really pressed the issue on the border, saying, okay, we want Ukraine funding, we want Israel funding, we are going to bundle that together with maybe not all of HR 2, but let's say a couple big top line wins for border hawks and for the Republican conference. I'm sure some people would have been mad. It doesn't go far enough. We want all of HR 2. But if he had pared it back but made it something good that would be unequivocal progress on the border issue and jammed that together with Ukraine and Israel, there's a decent chance probably that it doesn't pass because the Democrats whip against it and they want to do what they're going to do on the border crisis, which is they're in favor of it. Their policies are pro-border crisis, pro-illegal immigration, and they want to shield Biden from embarrassment and all of that. So I think the Democrats, maybe in the House, plus some, you know, some Republicans angry for other reasons, might have tanked the bill in the House. Or let's say it passes, basically on party lines, maybe with a few Democratic votes out of the House, and then Chuck Schumer bottles it up in the Senate. Then it's like, okay, now what? If you're not going to have that actually signed into law, if you also believe in the funding for Israel and the funding for Ukraine, and it's just twisting in the wind in the Senate because Chuck Schumer's not going to bring up a vote on that, or they're going to kill it with the Democratic majority in the Senate, you know, then what happens next? You can say, oh, look, the Democrats care about border insanity more than funding our allies. I think that would be a completely fair political attack. You can bludgeon them with it on the campaign trail.
Right.
But in the meantime, the Israelis aren't getting that money. The Ukrainians aren't getting that money. I've heard, and you might disagree, that the intel suggests they really need those resources right now with what's coming with the Russians. So I get what the political value might have been in jamming the Democrats and forcing them to basically say anything on the border is a poison pill. But if you actually believe the rhetoric on the foreign policy stuff and helping our allies, time is of the essence. Do you get that concern that I, and the point I'm making?
Yeah, Guy, absolutely I get that concern. And if you're staring at the Ukraine, you're going, well, my gosh, I mean, if they run out of, you know, the ability to fight back against the Russians, and I don't want to get into too much of the details of what's classified or not, but then the Russians can run right through Ukraine, go through Kyiv, and now you've got a real situation on your hands, or on the western flank of Ukraine, you know, threatening Poland and Latvia and Estonia. I get all those arguments. I mean, and I want to stand athwart Putin. But let's be very clear. Number one, we've given them $113 billion. $44 billion of that was lethal aid. That means there's another $69 billion that – what did they do with that? All right, now some of that was our fault, their fault, whatever. My point is we have not managed that very well. Problem number one. Problem number two, we're not paying for it. Problem number three, they want this money, and I still don't know what the mission is. Problem number four, they're going to be back at the well in December or January wanting more money, and then there's going to be an effort to want to rebuild Ukraine. Put all that aside, the point you're asking. Okay, but nevertheless, we don't want, you know, Russia to march through. The reason this mattered was you've got to put this out there, you know, months ago before you're up against the wall, number one. Number two, you've got to mean it, and you got to dare Chuck Schumer and those guys to do it. And what I would have done was put the bill on the floor that would have funded Ukraine with HR2, or as you pointed out, the key components of it. Let's strip back parole and asylum and certain pieces. And send that over to the Senate. And then if Chuck Schumer's really going to jam that up, then he's going to have to own that. I'm just telling you, part of life is negotiating. I don't believe it. I just flat don't believe it. If you would have stuck that to him, I think we would have been an overbearing amount of pressure to fund Israel, fund Ukraine, and secure the border of the United States. And that fight would have been worth it. That would have been a fight that would have galvanized our people. And I think we could have forced them to the table in a way that would ultimately possibly help Ukraine. One final point. It is not clear to me that Ukraine has the bodies to win this war, even if they have the ammo, because this administration has been slow walking it out of fear of escalation, not giving them the stuff to win it because we haven't had a clear mission. And now Ukraine men, they've lost some because they've fled the country, and they've lost 100,000 bodies. You know, they're struggling to have the men to fight the war, regardless of what we give them.
Okay. Understand that point. The scenario that you lay out is certainly plausible. I think you can say that is what the leverage game should have looked like. And I understand that. And I'm willing to entertain it. I still would have voted because I agreed with the actual substance of the bills that passed. I would have voted for them. But I fully comprehend and am sympathetic to the point that you're making. You're also making this point about Speaker Johnson, that he insisted for many months these two things had to be linked. Then all of a sudden, snip, the linkage was gone, and the votes came up. I think some people felt like that was, you know, maybe a bait and switch or a little bit of whiplash. President Trump, former President Trump, was asked about this because there's people in the Republican base who are upset with Speaker Johnson about this. Of course, some of your colleagues are talking about trying to vacate that position, the motion to vacate, throw him out of the speakership, like we saw with Kevin McCarthy. Here was Trump yesterday on a radio show in Cut 20 talking about Speaker Johnson.
We have a majority of one, okay? So it's not like he can go and do whatever he wants to do. I think he's a very good person. You know, he stood very strongly with me on the NATO when I said that NATO has to pay up, and they have to pay up soon and fast. And he has stood strongly on that. He agrees with that. He also got some of the money in the form of a loan, quite a bit of the money in the form of a loan. And he, you know, felt on that. But it's a tough situation when you have one. I think he's a very good man. I think he's trying very hard.
All right. So kind of my interpretation of that is cut him some slack. We barely have a majority at all. This is tough. He's trying to manage it. And P.S., I'm adding this part myself. P.S., we're in an election year. I'm going to be on the top of the ticket. Let's not throw ourselves into total chaos with another speaker fight right now. That was my reading between the lines. I could be wrong, but that was my interpretation of what he said. What do you think about, A, his assessment of Speaker Johnson being a good man and all of that, and how does that reflect on what comes next? Should there be a motion to vacate? Should what just happened over the weekend, in your mind, cost Speaker Johnson that position?
Well, number one, of course Speaker Johnson is a good man. I've known him a long time. Number two, I believe that it was still nevertheless a failure. And I believe that the votes over this weekend were, frankly, structured in a way that put a lot of us in a very bad spot, having to vote in a way that we didn't need to have to vote for if the speaker had done it a different way. I think that's a problem. I think number three, of course the president's saying that, all right? He's an election cycle. And you know what? In broad terms, I will tell you without divulging confidences, the overwhelming sentiment among even conservatives angry at him is that we need to focus on beating Democrats in the fall and not have that kind of a debate right now heading into election season. That being said, you know, I was on your show. I did not think we should vacate Kevin McCarthy. I don't think we should have been in this position. I think we were getting a lot done last year, and unfortunately, we went down that road. But what I would tell you is there is overwhelming frustration with the speaker right now because of the way this was all set up and done. You can't just decide.
Okay, and
to
I
do
get
it.
That. And I don't want to cut you off, Congressman, but we're up on a hard break here in just a second. But just quickly, it sounds like despite those frustrations, which you say are well founded, and I get it, you don't feel like the solution right now is the motion to vacate. Is that your position?
Currently, but he still has a lot more he's got to lead. And the final point, whoever's going to be our speaker and our leadership team come November, they better damn well mean what they say and do what they say. We're going to have a serious litmus test heading into January about who's leading Republicans because we're tired of this kind of garbage where we cut deals and we turn away from what we said we would do and make people like me have to vote against Israel because there's $9 billion that can go to Hamas in it, which was an unforgivable vote to put on the floor.
Congressman Chip Roy of Texas, our guest on the Guy Benson Show. Congressman, thank you.
Thanks, Guy. Take care.
We'll be right back.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.
Back here on the Guy Benson Show, we're just talking about the foreign aid package with Chip Roy from the House. Passed out of the House. Now it's on to the Senate. That's being debated right now. The expectation is it will pass the Senate and will become law. In the U.S. Senate, two members from opposite sides of the aisle have been saying some interesting things, well, one of them at least, about the other. John Fetterman, Democrat, Pennsylvania, who's a Harvard grad, he actually endorsed the idea that was floated by someone that Mitt Romney, who's retiring from the Senate, become the president of Harvard to clean that place up, which has become a mess. Romney's a turnaround specialist. He knows how to lead organizations. Harvard needs it. Boy, they would lose their minds if he were in charge, but I think it's actually a pretty damn good idea. I again agree with Fetterman. Another hour next.
A new generation of conservative talk. Right here, right now. Fair, fun, and backed by the trusted voices and reporting resources of Fox News. Fox News. You're listening to The Guy Benson Show. And now, here's your host, Guy Benson.
It's a new hour here on The Guy Benson Show, our middle of three. Thanks so much for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com is our website, the podcast, free of charge, on demand, as soon as the show is over, right around 6 Eastern. And then that hour on Fox News Channel, I'll be joining Brett Baier's panel on Special Report. Hope to see you there. Fox News alert as we enter this middle hour. The Dow surging again today, up 263 points at the close, finishing up at 38,503. Back with us here on the show is Clay Travis, founder of Outkick.com and a Fox News contributor. Clay, welcome back to the show.
Hey, appreciate you having me, man.
Of course. So I saw an observation that you made, and a number of other people did as well on social media, as we watch some of the madness and the vitriol and the ugliness play out at a number of college campuses around the country. You said, you know, it kind of seems like some campuses seemingly are immune from this kind of thing. And I saw there was actually a report where they listed all of the schools, all the colleges and universities around America that are currently under investigation for systemic anti-Semitism or incidents along those lines. And Iowa Hawk, who is terrific on Twitter, broke it down by athletic conference. And more than half of the Ivy League is under investigation. A number of schools in my conference, the Big Ten, under investigation, including my alma mater, Northwestern. The SEC, which is expanding next year, if you include all 16 teams, 0-16, not a problem in the southeast part of the country. And, Clay, it feels like that isn't just a random coincidence, right?
No, thanks for having me on. I think it's actually representative of a really important story that is not being told right now. And that is, for all of the talk about Charlottesville and the awfulness that happened there, I believe it was in 2018-ish, if I remember the year correctly, that is actually not representative, by and large, of where anti-Israel sentiment now dwells. That is, and I condemn it, as I think anybody with a functional brain should, if you are engaged in acts of racism or you are anti-ethnic in any way, I think you should be condemned. Biden himself said Charlottesville was such a stain on America that he felt compelled that he needed to run for president of the United States. And it was easy for him to attribute that to right-wingers and Trump and the anti-Semitism that he felt was embedded so deeply in the American right. I actually think what we're seeing now is the truth, which is it's actually the left and their identity politics coalition that is more likely to be anti-Israel and anti-Jewish. And I think my theory on this is because, unlike, let's say, in the Middle East, where clearly a huge part of the reason why Israel doesn't get along with its neighbors necessarily at a high level is the religious difference, right? The difference between the Jewish faith and the Muslim faith. And certainly you can throw in Christian elements as well. That's not what's going on in the United States. And I think it's a really important distinction. What happens in the United States now is the left has built an identity politics worldview, a sort of pyramid of victimization is the way that I have described it. And it relies upon white people always being colonizers and always being oppressors, such that Jewish people are seen as white even when they are being attacked and 1,200 Jews are being murdered in cold blood.
Even when they're not white, too.
Right. They are seen as the white people, and it isn't really a religious race-based decision, which is how you see all these ridiculous people walking around with, like, you know, gays for Gaza, which is such a cognitively dissonant argument that only in Western civilization could an absurdity of that level and magnitude be occurring. So I think this is such a seismic issue. And I don't know what you think about this, but I was having this conversation with my wife last night. I talked about it with Buck on our radio show today. My cautious hope here is that the identity politics worldview, which I think is the root toxicity of American culture today, could blow up over this because you've got two different groups that are traditionally Democrat voting, Jewish people and people of Arab descent, and they're not able to reconcile this because Trump isn't to blame in some way to unite them. And my hope is that white, black, Asian, and Hispanic, gay, straight, whatever your identity happens to be, that your individual intelligence will come to overwhelm the identity politics coalition that has all too often been used to divide us over what I would say is the last 10 or 15 years.
Well, I hope you're right, at least on that last point. I'll make two points in response. Number one, with President Biden, and you were going down this path, and this returns to my main thrust of my opening monologue in the first hour today. Biden, you're right. He said Charlottesville was the impetus for him to run for president. And he had to run for president because we can't accept that in our country, that type of horrible incident in Charlottesville. And he put the onus on Donald Trump for equivocating in his condemnation and, you know, the fine people on both sides. Whether you think that's a fair characterization of how Trump treated it at the time, that was very much the way that it was reported and the way that Biden presented it in announcing his run for president, which was ultimately successful. Here you have this just bile, this nasty hatred, all the vile tactics and even violence of the anti-Semitic identity politics stricken left. And Biden is doing his own kind of both sides thing here, which is such a moral failure by his own admission, by his own standards. In fact, the most important standard, according to him, which is why he ran for president in the first place. He failed his own test. He's been failing it now for months. He really failed it yesterday in the comments that he made. And since you also talked about Gays for Gaza, I'll just add a second point. I saw one of these nutty left-wing socialist social media accounts that have huge followings, and these insane tweets do very well and get shared all over the place, saying, oh, well, they think it's a good point to say, do you know how gays are treated in the Middle East? It's like they don't want to grapple with how gays are treated in Texas and Florida. Like there's some kind of remote equivalency between those two examples, like where people are thrown off of buildings, hanged, executed, imprisoned in the Middle East versus a made-up don't say gay controversy in Florida. That's how they handle. That's how they respond to the critique that you were just making. And it's to your overall point, I think it's so offensive. It's such obvious BS that even they don't believe. My hope is some people say, OK, if that's the argument that they're making, I can't subscribe to that. That is on its face preposterous.
Yeah. And that's why I try to be optimistic about this, because it's, I think, a dark time to have this many, in theory, highly educated college campus kids who are willing to be unable to see the difference between good and evil. And we've been making the analogy, and I bet you've had some discussion along this lines as well. If there were a group in Mexico that crossed into the United States and killed 1,200 Americans and kidnapped 100 of them, and by the way, it's as if the hostages don't even exist. I mean, we're still talking about over 100, I think, hostages, still unclear about what's happened to them. Five Americans, I believe, American citizens. It's as if those people don't exist. If that had happened in the United States, we would have rained down holy hell on the group that did it. And anyone with a functional brain in the United States would have supported it. So the idea that Israel, which is 100% innocent in the attack that was perpetrated against them on October 7th, doesn't have the right to defend itself or should be held culpable for people who are dying in their attempt to eradicate Hamas's ability to ever do this again, is such a historic failure to comprehend the difference between good and evil that I have to take the next step and hope that there is something positive that comes out of it, which to me would be, like you just said, people having to confront this. Maybe they're Jewish. Maybe they are young and they've just been historically voting Democrat. Maybe they're older and they haven't really looked at what the Democrat Party can represent today. I hope that it requires some measure of contemplation about how we got here, because I've seen it coming for a long time, and I hope that there is some positive that can come from it.
I tweeted this earlier, Clay, because for the hardcore people who are lost, it is beyond reasoning with them, right? It is, they are irrational, deeply ignorant, and unfortunately in some cases actually evil. They are bad people rooting for evil. And I tweeted, it's nearly impossible to reason with people who celebrate an actual genocidal terrorist massacre and shout the terrorists' own genocidal slogans, then rationalize their subsequent insanity, bullying, and bigotry as fighting a quote-unquote genocide that doesn't actually exist. They've invented a genocide, attributing it to the victims of October 7th, and then they use the fake genocide to rationalize all manner of evil and ugliness, and it's playing out prominently in major cities and college campuses. But coming back to my initial question, not a lot of campuses. And I saw an amazing juxtaposition on social media yesterday. It was a screenshot of the violence and chaos at Columbia. And on the other side was, I believe, the basketball arena at the University of Florida set up for a huge Seder, Passover Seder dinner, which was attended by hundreds, if not thousands. It went off beautifully, without a hitch. It was peaceful. It has been made clear, and Florida is my example here, but this could apply to a lot of other places. It has been made clear from the very top in the state of Florida, the governor, Ron DeSantis, said, this will not fly in Florida. It's not going to happen. Ben Sasse runs that school. He said the exact same thing. They enforced penalties and consequences early on. And Florida, University of Florida, doesn't have this problem. You can go down the list of some of the other schools that I mentioned. Vanderbilt had a problem. They suspended people. They expelled some people.
That's
if
right.
you actually show leadership and handle it, there's a way to put an end to this or at least significantly mitigate it. I think that is not just a juxtaposition in leadership. It is such an indictment of the places where this is out of control because the antidote is right there in front of us.
Yeah, I give credit to, you know, I went to law school at Vanderbilt, and there are a lot of decisions that I haven't always agreed with, like anybody can at a university. But the new chancellor at Vanderbilt penned a Wall Street Journal editorial page explanation of his decision. And he said, look, you have the right to freely speak your mind at Vanderbilt University. The First Amendment's alive and well. You don't have the right to trespass on university property. You don't have the right to, and I believe there were three people charged with criminal offenses for assaulting individuals. They were immediately kicked out of school for being charged with crimes. All of the students who violated the trespass rules were suspended immediately. I think that's exactly the way that everybody should be able to respond to this issue. And I would point out that their rights to free speech aren't being taken away. A lot of people don't understand the First Amendment or how it applies. But as long as you apply content-neutral policies, whether you're a Democrat, Republican, pro-Israel, or anti-Israel in terms of what you want to espouse, I think you should have the right to do that. But you don't have the right to take over university campuses and university property. And the fact that we can't get a solution in Columbia or NYU and that Harvard and Pennsylvania and MIT have had such a difficulty grappling with this issue, which, as we talked about, morally does not appear to be a very difficult problem, is, I think, evidence of the toxicity that has taken over the identity politics coalition of the Democrat Party. And
institutional capture, institutional capture, intellectual and moral rot in these places, and watching the people who are doing it properly and those who aren't. I mean, it is a real case study. Finally, Clay Travis, quickly, the owner of the New England Patriots is a Columbia alum, Bob Kraft. He was on Hannity last night. He talked about pulling his funding for the school because of what he's been witnessing, much to his chagrin. Here's what he said to Sean in Cut 7.
I never thought I'd see what's going on in America, what's happening right now, and it really pains me to see it. You know, we have our holiday going on now. It goes back to memory of thousands of years ago where negative things were happening, and the same is happening now in this great country that offered so many opportunities to our families who came here as immigrants. And we have to keep it open. We can't have this intimidation that's filtering through all these colleges and the hate continue to grow and multiply the way it is.
He said he doesn't trust Columbia to keep Jews safe right now, so he's yanking his funding. Quickly, Clay, is that what we need to see more of at some of these places?
I think so. You know, I think Robert Kraft has not been great on every issue, but he's right on this one. Now, I think he was so supportive of BLM. I think that BLM has helped to create some of the world that exists on college campuses now, which is not a positive reaction. But I think he's seeing that the crazy people have been unleashed and that there has to be consequences for their crazy political ideas and, frankly, their occupation of campus.
And he has leverage to do it, and he's using it. Clay Travis, Outkick.com founder, Fox News contributor. Clay, appreciate it. Enjoyed it. Let's talk soon.
For sure. Sorry about Northwestern, by the way. They've really lost their way, and I know you're an alum. That has to be very difficult.
Oh, don't get me started. I'm on a break, but I'll blow right through it if you bring up Northwestern. That's another conversation that we will have. Clay Travis on the Guy Benson Show, stepping aside and coming right back.
In the swamp, not of the swamp. Guy Benson.
I'm Guy Benson. We're back. So one of the Hamas shriekers cornered actor Alec Baldwin in a coffee shop. And cut 17.
Just say free Palestine one time. One time. One time.
Call the police.
One time, Alec. You know he's a criminal. You know he's a fucking criminal. Come on, Alec, just say free Palestine one time. One time, just one time, please. And I'll leave you alone. Free Palestine. F*** Israel, f*** Zionism. Please say it. One time. Could you give me one quick
favor? And then he slaps the phone out of her hands. He has a bit of a temper, that is well known. But I'll say this. If you are managing to make me sympathetic to Alec Baldwin, where one of his outbursts at least seems somewhat understandable to me, congratulations. You have really achieved something. And that young woman, perhaps they would call her a person born female, or whatever the terminology is these days, she achieved it. So congratulations. You are officially that insufferable and annoying. He goes, can you do me a favor? And then boom, down goes the camera. That's Alec. He's the better party in that exchange somehow.
In the swamp, not of the swamp, Guy Benson.
We are halfway through the Guy Benson Show on this Tuesday from the Tony Snow Studios in Washington, D.C. Thank you for tuning in. I want to make a few observations about a few things happening at Columbia that I think are particularly disgusting and outrageous. Now, I did notice on social media there was a video and images that were going around from the pro-Hamas, Hamas-sympathetic crowd. And what they're trying to do is gaslight the public and really work the media refs to make it seem as though when Jewish students and faculty say that they feel physically unsafe on campus, they want to say, that's a lie, that's an exaggeration, that isn't real. Now, the fact that you had the rabbi, one of the prominent rabbis on campus a few days ago, urging Jewish students to stay away for their own safety, that would be a very important element to this broader story, a piece of evidence, you could say. The fact that the Jewish Center felt compelled to have security escorts for students going to their seders for Passover, that's another, I would say, data point in this. We read yesterday from the firsthand account from a Jewish student about how he was harassed, intimidated, called horrible things, told to go back to Poland, with an Auschwitz reference, I would imagine, there, and was physically assaulted on campus within the gates of Columbia by this mob. And we've seen instances in the past, since October 7th, of pro-Israel Jewish students being attacked, being menaced, being bullied by these people. We also played audio of these shrieking banshees demanding that the bad Jews leave, driving them out of the quad, off of the lawns, which does not belong to them. They think it belongs to them. They are illegally occupying land, ironically, and claiming that it's theirs and refusing to leave, but also insisting that other people, students at that school who have every right to be there, if they think the wrong things, look the wrong way, they can't be there. Get out. You're not welcome. You take all of that combined, and it's very clear what an incredibly hostile and dangerous environment this is for the vast majority of Jewish people who are there who believe in the state of Israel and its right to exist and its right to self-defense. And polling shows that the overwhelming majority of Jews in America and Jews in the diaspora outside of Israel support the state of Israel. But, and this is the point I was getting to, there is a certain subsection of left-wing, hardcore, sort of statist, leftist, revolutionary Jewish people who have joined with this Hamas crowd, the pro-Palestinian movement, whatever they want to call it. And for those people, and people are entitled to their opinions and their beliefs, I know a lot of my Jewish friends view them as traitors, and it stirs quite a lot of anger. I'm not going to be in the business of adjudicating who is a good Jew or who is betraying their people. That's not my role here. I'm not Jewish. I'm staying out of that. What I will say, based on actual evidence, is the people who are siding with the Hamas apologists and worse on this dispute, who are Jewish by birth, it's their religion, their ethnicity, their parents, however they view it, however they see that heritage, they are in a small minority of Jews in this country when it comes to Israel. But they are front and center at a lot of these hate rallies on Capitol Hill, on campuses and elsewhere, because the Hamas crowd has decided for PR reasons to make them significant faces of their movement in order to try to inoculate themselves against charges of anti-Semitism. Oh, you can't call us anti-Semitic. We're not anti-Jew. We're not bigoted toward Jews. Look at these Jews that we have right here. So they actually had a little Passover Seder for the cameras in the encampment on campus. This was yesterday. And that was the video being shared around. See, look, oh, are these people in danger? The media tells you, and some of these lying Zionists tell you, that Jews feel like they're in danger. But here are Jews going through religious ceremonies for their Passover Seder right with us. We are just so peaceful and wonderful, they're lying about us. Now, this is literal propaganda. The people participating in it are knowingly engaged in propaganda. I don't know everything about Passover. I do know that under the Jewish tradition, the Passover Seder dinners are at night. And this was in the middle of the day. The videos, the photos, the sky is bright and blue in the background because really things get pretty hairy and ugly and concerning at night. That's where a lot of the other videos that we've played have come from, nighttime, where things get unhinged. But with all the reporters there and all the journalists in the middle of the day, it's like, here, look, please film this. We are not anti-Jew. Look at these wonderful Jews who are with us in favor of the complete annihilation and destruction of the Jewish state. See, we're ecumenical. That's what they're doing. That's the purpose of that performance, that show. Now, that brings us to a professor, and we have actually played sound of him in the past. His name is Shai Davidai, and he's a professor at Columbia. He, in the early days after October 7th, was the one sounding the alarm about the toxic, hostile environment on his campus at Columbia, talking about how he would never send his kids there, the place where he teaches, because of what he has personally witnessed. That video went around. And now, because he has continued to speak out, and he has been highly critical of the Columbia administration, I would say quite rightly, guess what has happened to this professor? And the context, let me pause, there was a huge faculty walkout in solidarity with the pro-Hamas mob and the people occupying the quad. Dozens, maybe hundreds, it was hard to tell from the video, a lot of faculty walked off the job, did this big walkout. The left loves this kind of stuff. This is what they do. They did a big walkout, and all the hundreds of pro-Hamas, so-called pro-Palestinian students were cheering them on. They were sharing the videos eagerly. Look at this wonderful movement that we have built, and the faculty is with us, and shame on the university, and they must meet our demands, and on and on and on. So you have faculty members by the dozens, maybe hundreds, joining in, lending their voice to this unruly mob that is engaged in an illegal occupation of private property. After they were cleared out, they just came right back. And a lot of the faculty at Columbia, this is just an asylum, they are siding with the inmates. But you have a few outliers, the most prominent of whom is this man I'm talking about, Shai Davidai. And guess what happened to him? Let me read to you from the New York Post. A Columbia University professor who has been a vocal critic of the administration's response to the ongoing anti-Israel student protests was barred from campus Monday after he tried to lead a pro-Jewish rally at the Ivy League college. Israel-born Shai Davidai, an assistant professor at Columbia Business School and an outspoken supporter of the Jewish state, was told that his ID, his faculty ID, had been deactivated, even as a massive new tent city sprang up on the Morningside Heights campus with some 200 protesters, all of whom would have had to use their Columbia IDs to get in. So Colombia is saying, oh, we're not going to let these interlopers, these outside agitators, join the protests on campus. These are the students only. So you have to swipe your ID, your card, to get onto campus. And the school has deactivated that card for this Jewish pro-Israel professor. So you have students breaking the rules, flouting them flagrantly, just double middle fingers, making demands, defund the campus police, divest from Israel, we're not leaving. We played you the audio yesterday of the girl bragging to cheers that they're costing Columbia thousands of dollars every day. They're going to try to disrupt and ruin commencement. They're very excited. They've driven classes to online, to virtual, because in part Jews don't feel safe on campus, despite the propaganda show that I was just mentioning a few minutes ago. So if all of that is being allowed, and if faculty members are doing big walkouts in solidarity, walkouts from their classrooms, from their offices, and they can all access campus, why on earth is the Jewish pro-Israel face of the opposition here, who's a professor in good standing at Columbia, why is he being literally locked out of the campus? Well, here's the key line from the New York Post story I was just reading from. He said administrators told him they banned him from campus because they could not ensure his safety. So that's the excuse. The excuse that they are using is that their campus may not be safe for this Jew, and therefore they're not letting him come to campus. They're locking him out. Now, he's been very critical of them. He's attacking the school, I think, for good reason. But all these other people breaking every rule and breaking laws and completely ignoring what the administration tells them, they can all show up on campus. Their cards, their access cards are fine. This one guy, he's out. He's locked out for his own safety. Oh, don't come here. You're unsafe. And just to prove that point, you're so unsafe here, we're not going to even let you show up. Meanwhile, a previous faculty member at Columbia, who the president of Columbia just testified last week before Congress, was fired, an openly pro-jihad, pro-terrorist lunatic, not a U.S. citizen, by the way. That person, who the school said under oath this person is fired, that guy is on campus, mingling and schmoozing and rallying with these fellow Hamas supporters. So he's not on the faculty, according to the administration. He was fired. He's an open fan, celebrator of terrorism. He's on campus. The anti-terrorism Jewish pro-Israel professor, he's locked out of campus by the administration, supposedly for his own safety, quote unquote. That's their explanation, he says, they gave him. What a complete, embarrassing outrage that is. I think he's an adult and he can decide whether or not he can safely go to his own place of work, a campus in the middle of New York City in the United States of America, as a proud Jew and proud supporter of Israel. They're making that decision, I guess, for him. But in the process, if they're telling him, oh, it's because we're keeping you safe, it's really for your own safety, that is just appalling. It is also undermining the entire pretense that currently some in the media and definitely on the hardcore left and this whole mob, what they're trying to convey, their line, is these are peaceful protests. And the Jews who claim that they're unsafe, they're liars and exaggerators doing this for Zionism to try to demonize us unfairly. And yet the school apparently is turning around and saying, no, no, we actually agree. It is not safe here for Jews. If you're telling a prominent Jewish professor who's outspoken on Israel, who the mob hates, we can't keep you safe here, therefore you're locked out of campus, you have a raging anti-Semitism violent threat on your campus by your own admission. I mean, it's sick, the juxtaposition. Here's 100 faculty members, 200 faculty members doing a big walkout with the Hamas crowd cheering on every step of the way. And then this man, equally a member of that faculty, but maybe a little bit less equal, because he's the wrong kind of Jew, his card has been deactivated for his own safety. I want you to hear from him in his own powerful words right after this break on The Guy Benson Show.
Miss a minute. Miss a lot. The Guy Benson Show.
We continue on the Guy Benson Show. We're talking about Shai Davidi, who's this Columbia professor, basically locked out of campus by his administration. He still led a pro-Israel rally, but he had to do it just off campus because I guess he can't get onto campus and maybe he doesn't want to risk breaking the rules. They break every rule. This is just like Hamas in Israel. It's a microcosm. Hamas breaks every rule of war and violates every norm and is just savage and barbaric and evil in every conceivable way. Israel tries to play by the rules of war. In fact, they go farther than most militaries on civilian casualties and trying to guard against that, etc. But they are held to a completely absurd standard, whereas Hamas, it's sort of like, oh, well, that's just what they do. Somewhat similarly, here you have the mob being coddled by the administration, apparently not respecting the rules at all, and then the professor, who's broken no rules, he's the one locked off campus, and I'm willing to bet, this is my guess, he doesn't want to show up anyway because they might use that as an excuse to then move against him in some sort of more formal discipline, saying that he actually earned this other sanction against him. That's my guess. But one of these self-described anti-Zionist, anti-Israel, let's destroy the Israeli state Jews tried to confront him. This is Professor Davidi. And he really went after this person with clarity, with passion. It was a lecture that this student, if it's actually a student, really needed to hear. Whether it penetrated or not, I don't know. But this is righteous fire in Cut 12.
You, I introduce myself as Shai Davidi. Look at me because I'm talking with you. I introduce myself as Shai Davidi. You introduce yourself as a Jew. You introduce yourself as a spokesperson for Jewish people. Because you, wait, listen to me. Because you said, me and many other Jews, so you have to look at the statistic. 95% of Jewish people are Zionists. So if you don't want to be part of the Jewish tribe, you have the right to do so. But you are not the spokesperson of the Jewish people. These, all of them here, are the Jewish people. You should be ashamed of yourself for insinuating otherwise. If you want to stand against terrorism, you're welcome to stand. If not, you're welcome to stand there.
He's saying, we actually represent Jews in this country. You don't. You don't have to be part of our tribe. You can reject all of it, but don't pretend to speak for us. That was the message there. And of course, he's right. Last thought, very quickly. I was watching that faculty walk out and all those hundreds of people cheering them on. It's not an institution of higher learning. It's an asylum, as I described it. And increasingly, we're getting closer and closer to that asylum charging students $100,000 every year for the privilege of attending what was once a prestigious school. With fewer and fewer people perhaps being attracted to a school like that because of scenes precisely like this. It's a completely unsustainable model. And as that model gets less sustainable and more expensive, it is a matter of time. Take it to the bank. We're seeing it right now that the inmates are going to continue even more loudly to demand that all of us, quote unquote, forgive the debt that they incur for taking on whatever loans they might have to pay for a $400,000 four-year college experience at a place like that, where it's hard now to differentiate between the inmates and the people running the place. And because you can't afford it if you're a normal person, you're likely to take out loans. And down the line, they're going to look around and say, wow, we really can't pay this back. Hello, taxpayers. We now, let's add a new demand to the pile. You need to bail us out. That's what Biden's doing now. It'll be even bigger with a larger price tag in the future for these exact people. Today and tomorrow, how about a hard no in advance on that next scheme? Final hour of the Guy Benson Show coming up next. Andy McCarthy is here with the latest on the Trump trial in New York. We'll get his legal analysis and acumen as soon as we come back.
Raise your glass to the Guy Benson Show Happy Hour. brought to you by the Finnish Long Drink. Finland's most popular alcoholic beverage is taking America by storm. Visit thelongdrink.com. And now, here's Guy Benson.
It's our final hour here on the Guy Benson Show on this Tuesday, the happy hour, sponsored by the Finnish Long Drink, thelongdrink.com. Always drink responsibly, 21 plus only. And here on the show, our website is guybensonshow.com. Our podcast is free on demand every day when the show is over. And we end right around 6 p.m. Eastern. In that following hour, around 6:45 Eastern, I'll be on the special report panel this evening. That's on Fox News Channel. Please tune in. Back with us now is Andy McCarthy, Fox News contributor, former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. He was a federal prosecutor for years, best-selling author. And Andy, as always, glad to have you back on the show.
Guy, it's my pleasure. Glad to be back.
All right. I want to start by playing some sound bites. This is the initial thoughts. This was yesterday after the opening statements in the Trump trial in Manhattan. This is the criminal trial. Our colleague, Jonathan Turley, who, of course, is a prominent law professor, he gave his initial review of the strength of the proceedings and the case against Trump on the news channel. Again, this was yesterday afternoon, starting in Cut 18.
What is clear is in this case, Trump is right. I mean, this is an embarrassment. I mean, the fact that we are actually talking about this case being presented in a New York courtroom leaves me in utter disbelief. I mean, the arguments today did, in fact, capture all the problems here. You know, you had this misdemeanor under state law where that had run out. This is going back to related to the 2016 election. And they zapped it back into life by alleging that there was a campaign finance violation under the federal laws that doesn't exist. The Department of Justice doesn't view it this way.
All right. The Justice Department at the federal level did not file charges on this exact set of circumstances. Alvin Bragg's predecessor in this role also made the same judgment call. Bragg then tried to resuscitate the case under this theory, and that's what we're now all watching and he's pursuing in court. Turley went on, Andy, and cut 19.
But also keep in mind, this is what Hillary Clinton's people did. You know, remember when they funded the Steele dossier, which they denied to reporters. They put it as a legal expense. And then they fought the eventual fine that they received from the federal government, saying, but it was a legal expense. But now you've got some of the same Democrats supporting this bizarre theory.
Okay, so he calls the case an embarrassment that leaves him in, quote, utter disbelief. I wonder what you make of that, Andy, and now that we're done with day two of the trial, what is your reaction so far?
Well, I haven't changed my mind, Guy. I've always thought that this case was an outrage. It's farcical. I don't actually believe Trump committed a business records misdemeanor because under New York law, even if it was just a misdemeanor, which as John correctly said, the statute of limitations ran on that after 2 years. But you have to show fraudulent intent. And one of the inconveniences of the proof that Bragg has on that account is that the state was not deprived of any tax revenue. Nobody – it's like the civil fraud case. There's no victim here. There's no – they're not going to be able to establish that Trump tried to defraud anyone out of money or property. So I don't even think he committed the misdemeanor violation. I continue to think – my friend Dan McLaughlin from National Review has it right when he says this is as if Trump lied to his own checkbook and they charged him for it. But the really outrageous thing is to try to inflate it into a felony by claiming that Trump committed or was intending to commit a campaign finance violation.
And dozens, right? Dozens of felonies?
34. But yeah. I don't think it's enough to say that Bragg does not have authority to enforce those federal statutes and that the Justice Department didn't enforce them. I think this is an episode of unseen collusion between the New York District Attorney's Office and the Biden administration, because the Justice Department's position, and I looked at this morning carefully because I wanted to make sure I was right about this. The Justice Department's position is that the Justice Department and the Federal Election Commission are the exclusive authorities in the United States for enforcing the federal campaign finance laws in connection with federal elections of federal office. And what they say is the Justice Department handles criminal violations. The FEC handles civil violations. There's no room for anyone else. They don't acknowledge any role for the state. And in a normal case, if Trump were not involved, if a state prosecutor tried to enforce federal campaign law under circumstances where the two federal agencies with exclusive authority had not brought cases, the Justice Department would go crazy. But they, of course, haven't here because it's Trump.
So do you think that is unspoken at all or just unspoken publicly? Do you think there might be some collusion behind the scenes like, hey, you run with this ball, we're not going to get in your way? Or is it just a wink and a nod, no one has to really say anything?
Yeah, I think they're all smart enough that they – look, Bragg was a federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York. He's been around the block. He doesn't need – explain to him, you know. I worked in that office for a long time, too. He knows how territorial the feds are about their jurisdiction. But what I'm, when I say it's unstated, Guy, what I mean is when we talk about the prosecutions brought by Jack Smith, we can see, even though they do this farce where they name Smith as a special counsel and they pretend that he's completely independent of the Justice Department, in fact, he exercises Biden's authority. He has no other authority, and he answers to Biden's Justice Department. So it's easy to see what the collusion is there. Here, it's not as easy to see because we're talking about a state prosecution and the federal system. But in fact, normally, if a state prosecutor was presumptuous enough to try to enforce federal law that he doesn't have authority to enforce, the federal authorities would be very active in trying to put
that would
down.
Intervene, saying, back off. This is not your ball game. This is our ball game. And it goes farther than that, just to underscore this a tiny bit more, Andy. It's not just like, hey, back off. We're going to pursue this because this is our venue. This is our province. You stick to your side of the tracks, basically. The feds have already reviewed exactly these facts, and they made the determination not to bring charges. So they've already gone through this. They've already made their decision. And then the opposite decision is being made by Alvin Bragg in New York City, trampling into an area that is not within his authority. And they're letting him do it. And I think you pointed out quite aptly, and it's obvious to everyone or to most people, they've done it for reasons that are political. Usually the territorial stuff, I mean, it's every police drama you've ever seen on TV. There's a trope, a storyline where the feds try to bigfoot the locals and the locals try to infringe on the feds and they get into these, you know, pissing matches. That's all strangely absent from this because the goal is the same, political goal is the same of Alvin Bragg and Merrick Garland's Justice Department. All that to the side, and I think it's central, but we've addressed it. Based on what we've seen in the courtroom these last 2 days, Andy, you think the case is awful. Sounds like you mostly agree with what Jonathan Turley is saying. But in terms of the mechanics of this, in terms of the jury that was selected, seemingly faster than you had told us you were expecting they would be selected, how do you feel the case is going? Is this a strong case given the audience?
Yeah, this is a very important point, Guy, because, you know, John Turley and I are in this system, and because we're familiar with it, we understand where the fault lines are here and why, you know, this is a transgression against normal procedure, why it doesn't make sense legally. But if I'm taking the question that you've asked the right way, the issue is how's the jury taking this versus how does somebody who is
precisely.
Yeah. And the answer to that is, he could very well get convicted. The jury is not going to be aware of all of the legal nuances and legal problems with this. The jury is going to take their cues from the judge. In fact, when jurors try to satisfy the court that they are suitable jurors, even if they've heard stories about the case that's under consideration, the thing they need to satisfy everybody about is that they will decide the case based on the evidence they hear in court, and the legal instructions that the judge gives them at the end of the case.
That's kind of like a conditioned precedent to getting
on the
jury.
And this is the judge, just to remind people, this is the judge who donated to Joe Biden's campaign?
Yes, and, you know, quite apart from that incident of bias and the fact that his daughter is a Democratic political operative who works for some of Trump's bitterest political enemies, including Biden and Adam Schiff. But even putting that all aside, more rubber meets the road here, Guy. This is the judge who's allowed this case to go to trial. The Trump people raised a lot of these objections that we're talking about in the pretrial stages, and Merchan, Judge Juan Merchan, who's the presiding judge, rejected them. So he's indulging Bragg's theories, and that's what.
Let's say, past this trial, they convict Trump on at least some of the counts. Obviously, it would be appealed. It sounds like you think that on appeal, where it's back to some of these discretionary prudential judgments made by this particular biased judge, when it goes before the appeals court, Trump might actually ultimately prevail there, just based on the strength of the legal argument, not some of the courtroom drama and some of the politics at play. But that might be too late. That might be the point here. They don't even care if it is held up on appeal. They care about getting Trump in handcuffs and Trump labeled at least for a period of, a few months leading up to a certain time on the calendar, a certain date specifically actually on the calendar, with that moniker, convicted felon. That seems to be the whole objective here, much more than any sort of, you know, legal justice or redress of some harm that, as you pointed out, there really wasn't any provable harm to anyone. That just comes back, I feel like, to how political this feels to a lot of people. They may not even care if they get a conviction, if it stands. They just want to get the conviction during a certain window of time for reasons that are abundantly obvious.
Yeah, I wouldn't hesitate to say that they don't care, Guy, because to round out what you just said, which is all true, this is a case where the action in the case goes back 9 years. They have David Pecker today testifying in court about stuff that happened in 2015. The crimes alleged happened in 2017. Bragg waited 5 years to bring this case so that he could tee it up for trial during the months prior to the 2024 election. It couldn't be more patent what they're doing here.
Yeah. And the alleged crimes here, misdemeanors, which you've been throwing doubt on anyway, but the misdemeanors that happened were in 2017. So by 2019, they would have lapsed in terms of the statute of limitations. And the only reason they've been able to dredge them back up is through this cockamamie bank shot to turn them into felonies, enforcing federal law that the feds have decided not to try to pursue in terms of this case. So, I mean, go ahead.
Even with that, they needed COVID. You know, 5 years wouldn't have been enough on the statute of limitations. They needed the 6th year that New York added on account of COVID to barely slip this in under the finish line to pretend that it's a felony so they could try it.
Andy, two more important questions on these and related matters. We'll get to them as soon as we come back after this short break on The Guy Benson Show.
New talk for a new generation. The Guy Benson Show.
Back with Andy McCarthy on The Guy Benson Show. I want to ask you two more questions, one about this case, one about a related matter also in New York. This gag order. I know the prosecutors keep saying Trump is violating the gag order. He's speaking out about this. He's putting it on Truth Social. They want him held in contempt. They want him fined $1,000 every time he does it. Trump is saying this is insane. They're coming after me with this garbage political case, and they're telling me I can't even talk about it publicly. So he is, it seems to me, talking about it publicly. Do you feel like they're going to hold him in contempt? Are they going to start fining him? And what do you think about the justice angle, the fairness angle on the gag order component of this?
Yeah, I think it's completely inappropriate. I do think they're going to find him in contempt. I think they'll start with fining him. But the shot across the bow is that it's not just a potential $1,000 fine. It's a potential 30 days incarceration for each offense. So the threat that they're trying to float out there is that Judge Merchan could actually order Trump to be incarcerated for up to 30 days and continue to order him to be incarcerated if he continues
to violate the gag order. There's no doubt that he's violating the gag order, but the gag order is utterly inappropriate. It is directed only at Trump. So you have a situation where this loathsome character, Michael Cohen, is speaking out against Trump just as Trump is speaking out against him. Cohen can say whatever he wants to his heart's content because he's outside the gag order, but Trump isn't. And the other thing is, constitutionally speaking, there are much more important considerations than the administration of justice in this case. What Merchan's order interferes with is Trump's ability, which he has a constitutional right to do, to run for office, and the public interest in elections that are decided by robust political debate rather than courtroom proceedings.
Right, and they're muzzling
Merchan
him there.
Care,
I mean,
about
it's
any
like
of that.
It's actual election interference of a certain strand, no doubt about that, a point that Trump is making. I think he's making that point correctly. Finally, Andy, on the civil trial in New York brought by Letitia James, the explicitly anti-Trump attorney general, the Democrat in that state, she tried to have the bond that he posted for appeal thrown out this week. She failed in court, but she tried. What happened there?
Yeah, she failed. Trump made some accommodations about not being able to touch any of the money that he's had to post. But I actually think, even though it was Slash Guy, that the $175 million is way too high also, because Trump has lots and lots of real estate in New York. You know, every fortune is different. If his fortune was in bags of gold that he could load into a plane and fly someplace, that would be one thing. But his real estate in New York isn't going anywhere. Mm-hmm. So if Tish James prevails on appeal, she'll have plenty of property to execute on, and Trump can't get rid of his property because it's now under a monitor.
So was this like harassment, where she was just trying to make his life harder again and revoke the bond just to basically further kind of persecute him? And she got overruled, but she tried.
It's what you said before, Guy. This is just the civil version of it. None of this is going to get rectified until the appellate process after the election. So what they're trying to do is make it as difficult as possible for him to seek office and to beat him up
along
the way.
Yeah, that's the key time period. Let's make his life as difficult as possible and have it, the headlines and everything, as bad as possible for him, caught up in courtrooms, that sort of thing, until roughly mid-November, and then things might seem a little bit less urgent for some reason after that. I mean, it is transparent, if nothing else. And we're going to keep covering it. There's other cases, I think, that are stronger at the federal level. These are the New York cases. And that's why we have Andy McCarthy here breaking it down with us. Fox News contributor, former federal prosecutor. Andy, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Guy.
And the Guy Benson Show is back with more. It's the happy hour, and it continues after this.
New talk for a new generation. The Guy Benson Show.
Home stretch, Guy Benson Show. Thank you for listening. GuyBensonShow.com, our online home. Podcast always free when the show is over. Coming up in just about an hour, a little less than an hour, I'll be on the special report panel, Fox News Channel. Hope to see you there, Brett Baier and the whole gang. Well, we've been talking on this program in recent months about wedding planning, wedding etiquette, invites, save the dates, all of that, because Dan, who was our technical producer and our engineer for years, he is getting married in the coming months. Now, he has moved on to the Will Cain Show, and we still see him around. We're still friends, of course. We now have Justin filling his shoes and doing a great job. But occasionally when we see Dan around and Christine sees him in the hallway, questions come up about the wedding planning process. This then led to a separate conversation within our team about wedding gifts. And there's a debate underway, and this is kind of a perennial conversation, but I saw there was a news hook recently where, once again, people are really arguing over whether or not you, as an invited party to a wedding, owe the couple a gift, a wedding gift, if you are invited to that wedding, even if you cannot attend. So you get the invite in the mail. Please join us to celebrate the union of so on and so on, such and so and so and so. It's on this date and this time. RSVP. And you look at your calendar and you've got a conflict, you can't make it, or you think, well, I'm happy for them, but I don't really know the couple that well. I don't think that trip, if it's a destination wedding or whatever, is going to be worth it. So for some reason, you have to decline. Do you, having been invited, still owe that couple a wedding gift anyway because you were on their list? Or do you only owe them a gift if you're going to the wedding? And I know some couples will say, no gifts, thank you very much. If you're traveling a long way to an expensive place, it's like, you know, don't even bother. Your presence is our present and all of that. But I'd say 95%+ of the time, a couple is expecting wedding gifts from people who come to the wedding. It's this second category of people who are on the invite list but aren't coming. Do you have an obligation of gift-giving attached to you by virtue of the invitation itself, even if you never show? So I kind of have a wishy-washy answer on this. It kind of depends on the circumstances. But unsurprisingly, Christine has a very strong take on this, which is what, Christine?
Hand over that cash. You have to give a gift if you're invited to a wedding. I'm not saying it should be maybe the gift that you would give if you were going to the wedding, because I have thoughts about that as well on like how much you actually should give. But I think this, that I would give something if I was invited to a wedding and I wasn't going. I thought that's a common thing.
What if, Christine, we shared your contact info with our whole audience? And, I mean, we all know you're on vacation all the time, so probably booked up. You can't really attend a bunch of random people's weddings in our audience. If they wanted a guaranteed gift from Cookie, can they just mass invite you to weddings for the rest of time?
Well, I don't.
You know, you might show up randomly, so that's the risk. But if you can't make it, you just are sending gifts to people, even if they're strangers?
Well, that obviously, no, that's not going to happen. But can I tell you something? If someone
Hang on. You just said you have to.
You're invited. I need to know the person.
But like, how well? Like, the psychic that you crossed one time in Times Square all of a sudden hands you an invite to the wedding, and you've never even really spoken to the person, but you kind of recognize them by name? Or one of your best friends that you make, you know, on a flight somewhere, and you're Chatty Cathy with someone, and then you land and you follow each other on Instagram, then all of a sudden, boom, a year or two later, you barely remember this person, but you're invited to the wedding. Off goes a gift?
No. And I don't think that they would invite me to a wedding. But can I just turn left here for 1 second? I often do. I am the best wedding guest. Like, you want me at your wedding. I'm going to dance. I'm going to rave about the food. I'm going to drink. And Bobby and I are really good together as wedding guests. Like, we really bring the party.
What if the food is bad?
I've had that.
You're going to rave anyway?
Yeah. Well, you know. I mean.
So the fact that you like the food at my wedding means nothing. Because you just admitted you're a liar
weddings. Your wedding was like insane. No, that's your wedding was like on a whole different level. Like,
yeah, that's what you're saying. But apparently you do the raving no matter what. You're a woo girl who will hype a wedding no matter how terrible it is. So for you to say, oh, yeah, yours was off the hook. It's just like you just have a rotation of superlatives that you go through to tell the people at every wedding you attend, oh, it's one of the best I've ever been at. It cheapens. It makes me sad, Christine, that you maybe didn't love my wedding as much as I thought you did.
I absolutely loved your wedding. And it's funny because there's only a handful that I would like rave about. And I mean, obviously yours was in Napa. It was amazing. But it's funny. Brian Kilmeade's producer, hands down, probably the best wedding I've ever been to in my entire life. And I tell her that all the time. It was years and years and years ago. But I always say to her, the best food I ever had at a wedding, probably better than my food. And I thought my wedding was spectacular.
Better than ours? I'm shocked.
So yours overall was an experience. I mean, I went to a place that I had never been before. It was like a weekend. Like, it was just like cool thing after another. It was like a totally different thing than just like, say, a wedding hall wedding. if that makes any sense. And my wedding was, you're making me feel awful. And I feel like I'm trying really hard to like scramble here. You know what?
Well, forget it. I don't know. Yesterday, you're like, oh, your favorite musical artist really isn't that good compared to Taylor Swift. Today, you're like, yeah, your wedding was fine. But I'll tell anyone I'll tell anyone it's great if
Dylan,
they invite
Justin,
me.
Dylan, Justin, does anybody want to help me here? Did I say the wedding was fine?
Right before this segment, you turned to me and you said, yes, he had an incredible wedding.
Thank you, Justin. Right,
no, I'm going to give her credit here.
No, that's the thing, though. You are saying that, but you also said this segment that you will rave about people's weddings even if it's not true. So the raving that you're doing, that's my point. It's watered down and not credible because you just admitted, Your Honor, we can read back the transcript. You just admitted that this is part of what you do. You hype up weddings even under questioning I asked you. Even if it's not that great, you'll lie. So that's what I'm feeling insecure about. I know we had an amazing wedding. I just feel like maybe you didn't really like it so much. You're just sort of playing the part to market yourself as the next wedding invitee. Because you're such a great presence at weddings, apparently.
What do you mean, apparently? I'm going to turn this on you. Bobby and I were great wedding guests at your wedding, were we not?
I really enjoyed seeing Bobby, and other people were there, too, with him, if I recall correctly.
Are you kidding? I made that night before. I was friends with everybody at your rehearsal dinner. I made a best friend, like a real best friend.
Did we invite you to the rehearsal dinner?
Yes. Don't you remember? That's where I really got tipsy. Don't you remember you watched me bring a to-go cup on the bus?
Oh, yeah. That is true. You had a go cup.
Yeah. And you're like, no, we're not. This isn't the type of. No, you can't just bring a to-go cup.
Well, you did. That's right. So I do remember that. Anyway, we've come far afield from the actual topic.
Let's go back. You got
to
pay.
Do you have to give a gift if you're not going to the wedding? How about this? Because we took such an extended detour there, going back to my own fantastic wedding in 2019, let's take a commercial break because I think we need to get back on the overall track here, and we will do that after the break. The debate that we tried to start, we always get distracted, don't we? The debate that we tried to start was if you're invited to a wedding and you can't or don't attend, do you still owe the couple a wedding gift? We shall focus during this break and then reconvene to actually address the topic of the segment in what has now become an extended version of the home stretch on this Tuesday on the Guy Benson Show Happy Hour. Please stay tuned. We will be right back.
Miss a minute, miss a lot. The Guy Benson Show.
It is the extended home stretch here on the Guy Benson Show. Thanks so much for tuning in. And we went a little far afield. We sometimes engage in some mission creep here on the Guy Benson Show, especially during home stretch segments. But I'm determined, because we've been talking about this topic off air for like a week. So I'm determined that we actually resolve our debate about wedding invite etiquette and whether or not you owe the happy couple a gift, even if you're not coming to the wedding. I generally say if it's someone that I'm close to and really like and feel like, oh, man, I want to be at this wedding, but for some reason I can't, like truly cannot, and I feel really bad about it, I will send a gift. If it's kind of like a marginal invite, probably not, or something nominal. I just don't feel like it's a hard, fast rule that you always have to send a gift just because you're invited. Because there have been a few where I've gotten invites, I'll never name names, where I was like, really? I'm invited to this person's wedding? That's interesting. And I'm not just going to like spend hundreds of dollars on them under those circumstances. I'm not.
I don't think you need to spend hundreds, but you need to give some sort of gift. And also, do you believe in covering your plate at least, like as the bare minimum, as a gift per person?
Well, is this just cash? Because I usually get things. Like I go to their registry and get them stuff that they're asking for.
Yeah, but that's for the shower. Then you got to give. I think this is different in different areas of the country. Like in Jersey.
No, I'm getting one gift. If you're invited to the wedding and I'm going.
Right.
I'm getting one gift. And then I'm done.
Oh, okay. So I think it's a little different. Maybe this is an Italian thing. Like, you have the big shower, and that's where everybody gets your registry gifts, and that's when you open it. But then the wedding is a separate thing, and that's when you – because you're really, you know, giving money to start their life. To, you know, like, we got a lot, and we were able to put a down payment on a home. It was amazing.
Yeah. What about the couples who, like, divorce pretty quickly? Can you get a refund? Or like a prorated refund?
No.
Like, all right, I gave you $200 for the rest of your lives till death do you part. You made it 7 months. I would like 183 of those dollars back.
No, you cannot do that. And I would say if it's under a year, I would think the couple should give back all of the gifts.
Oh, wow. You've got all sorts of rules.
I am a rule gal.
Random. You are not a rule gal. You have a bunch of doctors telling you don't take fake Ozempic, and then you do it anyway. You're not a rule gal. I guess in some circumstances you are. I may maybe. Generally, if I feel like I'm close to the couple and I'm going to the wedding, obviously, they get a gift. If I can't make it but I really want to, I'll get them a gift. If it's kind of a stretch of an invite and I can't make it, I don't necessarily feel obligated. And by the way, as you might remember, with our wedding, we didn't do a registry. We just did a honeymoon fund, and that's it. So there weren't two steps. It wasn't like, oh, here's our registered stuff, and then we want money later. It was just, hey, please help us pay for this trip to celebrate the new marriage. That's what we did. And so there wasn't really an opportunity for this double round thing that you're talking about. Maybe there's a cultural disconnect there. Very quickly, to the gentleman, Dylan, your thoughts on the gift question.
Yeah, we had no double rounding on the gifts. I'm with you. We just had the one. I mean, I was married a couple months ago. You don't do the separate gifts for registries and the shower. But I think I think I'm pretty aligned with you. Like, if they're a close acquaintance or a close friend, we'll get them something, especially because it's so easy to do now. Like, a lot of people have their own website that you can just go to their website, get a quick gift. But if it's like clearly somebody I haven't talked to in a while and I know they're inviting me on the off chance that I might be able to contribute like as a gift, I usually won't.
Yeah, and I can even say if it's like an acquaintance and it's kind of, again, on the periphery,
mm-hmm.
I'll say something like, oh, congratulations on the engagement. Sadly, we can't make the wedding, but next time you're in town, we'd love to take you for drinks.
For sure.
And it's not like fake. I will happily treat them to drinks, but that's different. That's kind of how I'll handle that sort of situation. Justin, your thoughts on this?
So I'll back up Christine on the bridal shower thing, because Hannah is the maid of honor in a wedding, and they're actually having the bridal shower on Saturday. Her and her bridesmaids are going together on a gift for their registry, and then there's an expectation for us to pay for something at the wedding, like a substantial amount of money. However, I think in terms of not going to the wedding, I think it would be nice for the guest to get a gift if they're not going, but I wouldn't expect that as the holder of a wedding to get something.
I think that's right. It's nice. It's like, oh, how kind. And we got a few people that we invited who couldn't make it, and they sent us something. It's like, oh, that is so kind of them.
Correct.
They couldn't make it to the wedding, but that's nice. Thank you so much. We sent them a thank you note. But it wasn't like, did you see? We invited so-and-so, and they're not coming, and they didn't even give us a honeymoon gift. That's just not the expectation. That's not the conversation that we ever have. It's also not how I am as a person, and neither is Adam, so that makes it easy. I think, Christine, if you invited someone to your wedding and they didn't come and they didn't give you a gift, how soon would a little gift of a severed pony head end up in the mailbox at that person's house? Like, do you give them a little period of time, like a grace period, and then chop goes carousel and you've sent your message?
I wish I could be as nice as you, but I think I would have a moment of, really? Especially if we were like super close or something and no gift. But one more thing, and I'm going to – you don't even have to answer this, but we had – an issue where a check bounced.
Ooh.
Now what do you do there?
Oh, you never speak of it again.
Huh.
You just say, oh, that is a tough situation for them. This is not worth pursuing further. So that's rude. It's awkward. It's just like.
But we got charged for the check bouncing.
How much?
Like $40.
Why would you get charged?
Our bank charged us for the check bouncing.
No. That's again, to me, that $40, if it's 40, that sucks, but it's not worth going there.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Excuse me. Your wedding gift was a check and it bounced. So now we're going to need that gift in cash. Plus, you need to reimburse us for the $40 that our bank charges, unless you're too poor and broke to do it. Like, what do you do that you can't have that?
Well, also, there's one more rule. You have a year to give a gift if you don't give it at the wedding.
Yeah, that is something that I did not know, but apparently that's somewhat common. That's something I discovered later on in the process. Like, okay, you've got this buffer zone of one whole year to get that gift in. Because someone actually did, like, just under the deadline. So like, oh, so sorry. I know it would be ruder if I waited any longer, but here you go, like 11 months later. All right. Thank you. Appreciate it. I would forget. I would absolutely forget. As soon as I accept an RSVP, at the same time I'm on the website, at the same exact moment I say, yes, we're coming. These are our dietary, not restrictions, but our preferences, because they usually have you do that. And then you go to the registry and get the gift. One fell swoop. I book my flights. I do all the stuff. Otherwise, I forget. I have to do it all at once and get it out of the way, clear it off my plate. That is the way that I do things. That's the way my brain works. Christina, I'd ask how your brain works, but that is a whole separate trauma. So we'll get to that over time. Let's put it that way. I got to run to Special Report up in the next hour on Fox News Channel. Back here tomorrow on The Guy Benson Show, actually from New York City. We'll talk to you then.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.